Today, my guest is on a mission to improve journalism. The author of 3 books, she has won the Pulitzer Prize and the National Book Award for nonfiction. She has a weekly column on the New York Times called Fixes, and she also the co-founder of Solutions Journalism Network. Ladies and gentlemen, my guest, Tina Rosenberg. Tina, thank you so much for being with us today. I know you're very busy these days, but tell us, what have you been up to?
Well, I have 2 things I'm working on. One is that I write a column in the New York Times called Fixes, which every week looks at a response to a social problem, what's something that's working and why it's working. And about 5 years ago, my co-founder, David Bornstein, and I founded an organization called the Solutions Journalism Network, and we work with news organizations to help them do these kinds of stories as well. Our goal is to spread the idea of solutions journalism, which we define as rigorous reporting on how people are trying to respond to problems. And that takes up most of my time.
Well, no, you know better than anybody else that there has been a lot of backlash on media and journalism. Is that the reason why you created the organization?
Well, we founded this back before it was quite so visible exactly what the sort of gap was between the media and the people we want as our audience. That has really, as you know, come into much more visibility since the 2016 election. But we have increased our work and changed our work since then because solutions journalism is a way for the media to build trust. And we have found that a lot of our news organization partners are using it that way. And let me give you an example. One of the news organizations we work with is the paper in Montgomery, Alabama, the Montgomery Advertiser. And on one of my trips, I asked folks in Alabama, what do you guys think of mainstream media coverage of Alabama? And they said, predictably, we think it's awful. Hmm. And I said, why? And they said, well, you always make us look like ignorant yahoos. And I responded, okay, tell me what's inaccurate. How can we do a better job on improving our accuracy? And they thought for a while and they said, well, it's not inaccurate. We do things that make us look like ignorant yahoos, but we also do a lot of things that don't make us look like ignorant yahoos, and you're not interested in those things. Mm-hmm. You're only interested in covering our problems and the issues that see us through the lens of our stereotypes. So I think this is true in every community that feels itself to be marginalized. People in inner city Chicago are sick of journalists coming in and just asking them about crime and poverty. Yes, those things happen. Those are big parts of our lives. But we have other parts of our lives, too, and we have ways that we're working to try and solve our problems. Please report on those. But that doesn't happen very often. So I think one big reason that people don't like the media very much and don't trust it is that they don't feel reflected or respected by the media. And taking a solutions journalism angle, when appropriate, can improve that, can change that.
You wrote a very interesting article about what journalism can learn from TV shows, that there's a lot more complexity in the story than just fact A, B, and C. Can you elaborate a little bit more on that?
Sure. Yeah, well, the idea is, look, if you want, a lot of classes in urban sociology around the United States have their students watch The Wire, the sort of probably one of the best TV shows ever made, a cable show about drug dealing in Baltimore. And I don't think there's anybody who would say that there's a piece of journalism that gives people a better picture of drug dealing in Baltimore than The Wire. Because, for many reasons, one of them was that they have, you know, multiple seasons to develop characters, but The Wire shows the complexity of people. It's not black and white. Journalists' tendency is to look for the simplistic, the black and white. We quote people on each side of an issue. We try and find the most extreme possible for the greatest contrast, and we confuse that with complexity. But it's not. Because most people, first of all, don't have extreme views. Most people have things where you know, they like Donald Trump in some ways and don't like him in other ways.
Mm-hmm.
And we don't tend to capture that. We tend to look for people who are, you know, completely to one spectrum or the other. So the piece I wrote in Fixes was really a plea for journalists to look at television. TV writers and showrunners know that viewers demand complexity. If we stuck to the shows that ran on network television in the 1960s and 70s and 80s in the United States, people would find those characters one-dimensional and dull and fake.
Mm-hmm.
But journalists don't acknowledge that readers can handle complexity, and we need to do that. It really humanizes our stories and depolarizes our stories. People don't think that there are reasonable views in America. They think people are super polarized on one side or the other, and that the reason is largely because that's what shows up in the media.
It is very challenging, and to put in comparison, because TV shows, they have time to develop the character season over season. And journalists, a lot of times, you have a deadline. You have to explain the situation in X amount of words and put everything in context. So it's definitely a very, very challenging thing to do. Is it even fair to compare both?
That's true, and that's a really good point. It is challenging. However, when you're writing a piece, no matter how short, you are choosing who to talk to and who to quote for it. And you can make choices that don't cartoonify the issue, that don't reduce the issue to oversimplistic form. You can choose people who have more complex and more nuanced ideas to talk to and to quote.
Do you think the fact that anyone can have an outlet to report anything they want, they can write about anything the way they want, how they want it, and you might find a public out there, do you think that approach might be muddying the water and confusing for the readers in general?
I would agree with what you said in part. I don't think it's the explosion of new producers of journalism, the fact that anybody now can have a blog and call themselves a journalist. I think it's the new amount of choice we have in what we consume. We now largely consume the journalism that our friends send us on social media.
Mm-hmm.
And that means that we're getting stuff from like-minded folks. And people tend to pass along stuff they agree with and stuff that produces strong emotion. And therefore, we tend to live in journalistic bubbles and read and watch and listen to stories that show the most outrageous things or the most extreme things. I think that's the problem.
I see your point, but my question for you is, can a journalist be completely unbiased?
No, of course not. And I don't even think journalists should pretend that we're unbiased. What we can be, however, is fair. We can present the story in its nuance and complexity in a way that people on all sides of the issue will say, my voice was represented in that. And that's a fair accounting of the issue.
One thing that I think is very odd is that newspapers and even media outlets who endorse candidates, I think it's very interesting, because at the end of the day, how can you claim you're doing a proper reporting when you openly endorsing one candidate over the other?
You know, that is such a great question. Journalists don't understand what the public understands about journalism. Journalists think that everyone gets that a newspaper's editorials and our editorial positions are completely different and separate from our news side. Now, most people don't understand that. So I think you're right. I mean, the fact that a newspaper endorses a candidate does, in the minds of readers, carry over to their news coverage, even though the journalists themselves don't think it does. I would also point out that in the last election, I do not believe there was a single mainstream media outlet of any size in the United States that endorsed the man who eventually won.
Mm-hmm.
If there can be a clearer example of how little influence newspaper editorials have, I don't think there can be one. I mean, I think a lot of news organizations are rethinking their editorial page and thinking, what are we doing this for? But I think it's important for news media to explain to people, here's how this works. These editorials are written by a group of people whose job it is to offer the publisher's opinion, and that's completely separate from the reporters on the news side.
You're right. I don't think any major organization endorsed him, but on the other hand, he got more exposure and more TV time than any other candidate by far.
That's true, and that was a tremendous amount of free advertising.
Well, let's talk a little bit about social media responsibility and part in all of this. Some companies have put in place new procedures and policies to avoid previous mistakes, but do you think they have done enough?
You know, I don't feel qualified to talk about that. I'm not really an expert on what social media companies are doing. I do know, however, that after the 2016 elections, a lot of journalists sat down and thought very seriously about our coverage and what did we do wrong. And frankly, I don't think the real question is how come we didn't predict who was going to win the election. It's not our job to predict who's going to win the election. Our job is to report what's out there. But I do think that there is a lot of room for improvement in how journalists report on America. And the answer isn't to say, we'll do more of the same, but we'll just do it in the Rust Belt, or in the Midwest, or in Appalachia, or in the South. That's not the answer. Because that isn't always giving you a true picture of what is going on. And so that is why I am so passionate about advocating that journalists should include solution stories in their coverage when appropriate. We should be covering what is going on. What are Alabamans doing? What are Kentuckians doing? What are people in inner city Denver doing to attack and solve their own problems and show that in the media? One of the reasons that Americans have very, very little trust, not only in the media, but in other people and in our institutions, is that we only see stories about corruption and dysfunction and failure. But that's not the whole story. We need to be telling the whole story.
I think as a consumer, sometimes I feel I don't have the opportunity to see the whole story. The news cycle is moving so fast. Each day something else happens and they move on to the next big thing. There's very little follow through with stories that happened months ago. So I think on the story aspect, what approach journalists and media outlets should take to make sure that the consumers are getting the full story? You know, we're getting everything from the beginning, the middle, and the end.
That's a great question. I mean, journalism is facing a huge economic challenge. I mean, the collapse of print advertising, the fact that the vast majority of online advertising goes to Facebook and Google, many, many news organizations, which used to have 40 employees, now have 5 employees.
So with all these changes, how do you prioritize? How do you choose which stories you're going to be writing next?
I think it's largely based on what are the important issues out there. Like this spring, I did, I think, 7 or 8 columns in a row on different successful responses to violence, to gang violence, and also I did three pieces on rape on campus, a program in Kenya, and also a program at the NYPD that was helping make sure policemen did a better job of processing rapes and dealing with rape victims. And I chose that because, you know, gang violence was in the news and sexual assault was in the news, but we don't necessarily hear about what works.
Mm-hmm.
So that's mainly what we do at Fixes. We try and look at what's working to combat the problems that people are talking about and thinking about and that matter to us.
In your book, Join the Club, you really talk about how peer pressure can be used for good, how that can be a force to improve the world. Can you tell us more about that?
Right. Well, I mean, peer pressure, that's an example. That's a force that most people think of as purely negative. Mm-hmm. But it's not, obviously. It's also positive. You know, being with peers who support you in a positive direction is super important. And it's often a way to solve problems that have not been able to be solved by other means. And in my book, Join the Club, I write about those. And they range from, you know, support groups like Alcoholics Anonymous to overthrowing dictators and getting people active in politics. Peer pressure is very important. But that's one method. There's many, many, many others. You know, there's lots of different techniques that people are using that are working to solve problems. And it's really important to highlight them and show how people are using them so other people can use them too.
Tiana, do you think the way you write has changed throughout the years? Have you been able to notice that?
Yes, actually. I mean, you know, I used to cover public health, human rights, and they were all stories saying, look how bad things are. And then I did one story that really sort of opened my eyes to a different way of covering these issues. Back in the year 2000, I was working for the Sunday magazine of the New York Times, and I wanted to do an investigative story on the price of AIDS medicines in poor countries and the fact that in countries where the AIDS burden was the highest, the cost of the medicines was also the highest, so nobody could take them. And that was widely known, but what was not widely known was why. And the answer was collusion between the pharmaceutical industry and the Clinton administration to put political pressure on countries so they wouldn't make or buy generic versions of drugs. So I thought this was a really important investigative story, and I pitched it to my editor, and he said, no, can't run it. Too depressing, not fresh enough. Everybody knows that people with AIDS are all going to die in Malawi. So I went back, and I rethought it, and there was one country that was defying this pressure and basically telling Washington and pharmaceutical manufacturers to go to hell and making their own generics and providing them for free to all their people who needed them, and that was Brazil. So the story then became what Brazil was doing. And in the process of telling that, I could say everything I wanted to say about the pressures Brazil was facing and the bad behavior, the investigative story. So this was a completely different piece now. I mean, it got into the paper. It was fresh, because people did know that everyone with AIDS was going to die in Malawi. They did not know that people with AIDS were not dying in Brazil. It felt empowering to readers who would have been just really depressed at yet another story about the problem. And it had a lot more impact this way because it showed that a model existed, and it helped to shift the debate to how can we all do what Brazil is doing. So since that time, every time I write about a too depressing topic, which is still most of the time, I ask myself, is there a possible solutions angle I can use to tell this story?
No, that's fascinating because I grew up in Brazil and I remember people talking about that in the 90s. Well, let's talk a little bit about solutions journalists. How many people you have on board?
Ooh, I don't know if I could give you a head count. First of all, there's no such thing as a solutions journalist. People who use this tool also do other kinds of journalism. Practically nobody does only this, and you shouldn't do only this. We work with, I would say now, about 175 different newsrooms around the U.S., and we're starting to work internationally. We now have very strong partnerships with the BBC World Service, with The Guardian. We have a representative in Europe. We're working in Africa. We're about to start working in Latin America. So this is definitely growing. We also have, it's called The Hub, that freelancers can join and get access to our learning materials and tools and things like that. So I couldn't give you a specific number, though.
Looking back when you started 5 years ago, do you feel you have been able to accomplish everything you set out to do, or there's still a lot of work to do?
Oh, there's a lot more work to be done. I mean, we'd like to see solutions journalism be a tool that every newsroom uses. We're not quite there yet.
Now, something more personal. When you hear the President of the United States saying that the media is the enemy of the country, how does that make you feel?
My first instinct is that's what every dictator says. I've lived in two dictatorships. I've reported from dozens of others. That's what every dictator says.
And I'm sure you know that Twitter and a lot of the social media companies have blocked Alex Jones' accounts. I'm curious to hear your opinion. As someone who works in the media, do you think that goes against the First Amendment and his right to express himself, or those companies made the right choice?
I don't know. I mean, I really am not an expert on these issues. I do feel that everyone is entitled to their own opinion, but you're not entitled to your own facts. You know, you can have a point of view on the facts, but you can't just make up alternative facts and say, here's something that's true when it isn't. But then you run into issues of, is it the job of a media company, which Facebook is, to block you on that? And I think it's a very complicated problem.
As you mentioned earlier, most of the time you're writing about tragedies and things like that, and that takes a toll. I'm curious to know, how do you personally deal with that? How do you make sure that that doesn't interfere with your personal life?
Yeah, I think a lot of people are wrestling with that, readers and journalists. In fact, there was a recent new study by the Reuters Institute showing that by far the major reason that people stop engaging with the news is that they're too depressed by it. And I think a lot of journalists feel the same thing. Journalists don't like doing only negative stories, but I think a lot of them are afraid to try to change their menu because they worry that a solution story is going to come out sounding like advocacy or like cheerleading or like fluff or good news, and that's a no-no. So, I mean, our job at the Solutions Journalism Network is to show journalists how to do these stories with high standards so that they don't fall into any of these traps. I mean, what I do to solve this problem for myself is that I'm very often focusing on what is working to solve a problem.
Do you see solution journalism being used in universities, in schools throughout the country? Because what I think is that if that becomes a habit to the next generation and they're already using that tool, that's half the battle right there for you.
Well, I think you're right. We are working with many journalism school professors who want to teach this. It's really an exploding topic in J schools. Not only courses in solutions journalism, but a module in solutions journalism you can drop into an intermediate reporting class, for example. So we have a lot of professors who are working on that. But larger than that, we have in American universities and colleges, many, many students want to learn about social change and social entrepreneurship. But the teaching materials have been really hard to come by. A lot of professors who teach social change are stuck with using, you know, Harvard Business School case studies, which are 30 pages long and 30 years old, and they need new material. So we have a program called Solutions U that works with a database of solution stories that we've collected, and we are collecting, adding more on a daily basis. We have over 4,000 now that professors can use as material for teaching. And with Solutions U, both students and professors can upload, for example, course outlines, discussion questions, lecture outlines, ways that they're using this material. So that's something that we are just starting in numerous campuses, and that's really catching on. We have, I think, just in the last few months, hundreds of campuses that are using Solutions U to teach social enterprise and social change.
Well, that's very exciting. It's good to know that they're interested.
Yeah, we find it very exciting. And this is what young people want, especially, I mean, millennials and younger people, they don't want only to hear about the problems and then go home and put their heads under the covers. They want to know what's working out there that people can do to solve problems.
The last book you wrote was Join the Club in 2011. Do you have any plans, any new book coming up soon?
Not at the moment. I think to write a book, you have to have something to say that's big and that you can't say through other means. And I don't have that right now. If I have something to say, I can say it in my column and reach many more people than would buy my book.
Well, now that we're on the subject, I usually ask my guests to recommend a book. Do you have one in mind?
Well, I think I would recommend a book by my co-writer, David Bornstein, called How to Change the World, which is profiles of social entrepreneurs in various countries, Brazil, Hungary, the U.S., India, who have really started movements that have made a huge difference and how they did it. And it's a book that is both insightful and uplifting, and I heartily recommend it. How to Change the World by David Bornstein.
Tina, thank you so much for taking the time. I really appreciate it. I know you're very busy these days. And but do me a favor, tell everybody how they can find out more about your work and how they can engage with you on social media.
Well, thank you. My name is Tina Rosenberg. I write the Fixes column in the New York Times, which is nytimes.com/fixes. And I'm also co-founder of the Solutions Journalism Network, and you can find that at solutionsjournalism.org. My Twitter handle is T.I. Rosenberg, and it's been a pleasure to be on. Thank you.
Ladies and gentlemen, Tina Rosenberg. Hey, everyone. Make sure to like, comment, and let us know what you think. And don't forget to follow us on Instagram, Twitter, and Facebook.